A reading from the letter to the Hebrews. For Christ did not enter a sanctuary made by human hands, a mere copy of the true one, but he entered into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself again and again, as the high priest entered the holy place year after year with blood that is not their own. For then he would have had to suffer again and again since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the age to remove sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for mortals to die once, and after that the judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly awaiting him. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. As Jesus taught, he said, "Beware of the scribes, who like to walk around in long robes and to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces, and to have the best seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses, and they pay the sake of appearance for long prayers. They will receive their greater condemnation." He sat down opposite the treasury and watched a crowd putting money in the treasury. Many rich people put in large sums. A poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which was worth about a penny. Then he called his disciples and said to them, "Truly, I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who have contributed to the treasury. For all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on."
So that was a little different, eh? Singing the hymn before the sermon. But there's a good reason for it, because I'm preaching inspired by that hymn we just sang. So it made sense to hear it first before talking about it. And no doubt, as we sang that song, you recognized the connection it had with the gospel reading, right? The story about how Jesus was at the temple and watching people put contributions into the treasury, and there were people who were, you know, very wealthy, putting in a lot of sums of money. But then we come to this one widow who comes up and just gives the last few coins that she has. And Jesus wants to highlight that, and he points out the fact that whereas everybody else was giving some of their money, she gave all that she had. And so the hymn writer in verse 3 points this out. When Jesus saw her costly gift and knew she had no more, he praised a love that spared not self and called her rich, though poor. Which is a great message, which is a great thing to see, that in the example of this woman, we see someone simply giving of herself in a significant way and giving all that she had. And so the hymn writer took that theme and decided to connect it with what Jesus had done as well. And in verse 4, we see this. "At last he," that is Jesus, "brought his offering and laid it on a tree. There gave himself, his life, his love for all humanity." And so what the hymn writer is doing is not saying that the woman giving all that she had inspired Jesus to do the same, but simply saying that just as this woman gave everything, Jesus also gave everything in his crucifixion for us. And so then the hymn writer takes these two themes and puts it together with a wonderful application for us in the last verse. "Lord, help us all with you to yield whatever love demands and freely give as you have given with open hearts and hands." And this is a great message. And it lines right up with what we read about earlier in the Gospel of Mark, where Jesus said, even the Son of Man, Jesus saying, "Even I did not come to be served, but to serve and to give my life as a ransom for many." And of course, he said that right after telling the disciples that they needed to be the servants of others. And so the hymn writer does this wonderful job of connecting this gospel reading to what Jesus does, brings the two together and says, whether you want to say just like Jesus or just like that widow, let us also be people who are prepared to give of ourselves for the sake of others, to be generous, to not stop and hold back, but just to give it all over. That message in and of itself is wonderful and positive. It speaks to us, it gives us something to hang our thoughts on, It's a way to understand how, at the end of the service, when I say, let us go forth to love and serve the Lord, this message gives us an idea of how we might go and do that by following the example of the widow and of Jesus. But, unfortunately, there are aspects of this that don't work quite so well. The hymn writer has chosen to do something that actually isn't that uncommon. And we find this in verse 1. The temple rang with golden coins. The rich in bright array contributed from gleaming hoards. Their scales could scarcely weigh. Now, obviously, I read that with some inflection. But what's the general gist of verse 1? That you get in this hymn? The temple rang with golden coins. What's that, you know, how could that happen? The only way that could happen is if someone had a bunch of gold coins and they were like dropping it into the dish. You know, one, two, three, king, 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 king. Almost like someone's trying to say, yeah, look how much I'm putting in here, right? The rich in bright array, these people in their fancy clothes have come in. And now from their gleaming hoards, like these people are rich because they have hoarded money. They have just accumulated it for themselves. It's gleaming because it's all gold and silver. And their hoards are so great that their scales can't even weigh it all. There's so much of it. We get the impression in verse 1 that you have rich people coming in and going, yeah, look how generous I'm being, putting in some of this great wealth I have. And it sets up the story in this negative vision of the rich people in an effort to make the widow look better. Now, can I just say this? Just looking at verse 3, 4, and 5 alone, well, for that matter, verse 2, where it talks about the widow coming in, you don't need verse 1 for the rest of the story to be positive. You don't need arrogant, wealthy people for the widow's offering to be worth something, to be significant. But the hymn writer gives into the temptation that happens all the time to make more of somebody else in order to make the main character look better. Now, why am I saying that? Well, let's look at what the Bible actually says. When we read this passage in Mark, here's what it says. Jesus sat down opposite the treasury and watched the crowd putting money into the treasury. Who was putting money into the treasury? The crowd. Everybody is putting money into the treasury. Now, many rich people put in large sums. That's all it says. It doesn't say that they put it in with arrogance. It doesn't say that they put it in, hey, everybody, look at me. Just many rich people put in large sums. Isn't that what you would expect? Somebody with a lot of money would put in more than somebody without a lot of money? That's all it says. Many rich people put in large sums. A poor widow came in and put in 2 small copper coins, which are worth a penny. Then he called his disciples and said to them, truly I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the treasury. She put in more than who? Just what the rich people put in? No, she put in more than all those who are contributing to the treasury. Who was contributing to the treasury? Everybody, right? For all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on. Jesus's point is about what the widow has done over against what everybody else was doing. Now, this story doesn't show up only in Mark 12. It also shows up in Luke 21. And in Luke 21, yes, only the rich people are mentioned. But again, it's just very straightforward. There are rich people that put in lots of money. There's no sense that these rich people were doing it arrogantly. In fact, especially taking it from Mark, where everybody is giving, let's remember the context. Jesus is Jewish. He's in the Jewish temple. And everybody else is Jewish. And what are Jews supposed to do with their money according to the Torah? They are supposed to tithe. That means they are supposed to give a tenth of all that they have. So everybody coming into the temple is doing what the Torah says they're supposed to do. So a guy who comes in having made $1 million that year is putting $100,000 in the treasury because that's what he's supposed to do. The guy who makes $10,000 is putting only $1,000 in the treasury. Now, it's important for us to understand how math works. 100,000 is more than 1,000, right? Significantly more. But then this widow comes up, and all she has is a handful of coins. What, 25 cents? A couple of loonies maybe, whatever? She puts that in the treasury. But rather than just being 10% of what she had, she put in 100% of what she had. And that is what Jesus points out. This woman gave more than everybody else. Really? Well, on the basis of percentage, yes. She gave all that she had to live on. Whereas the guy who made $1 million only gave 10%. The guy who made $10,000 only gave 10%. And let's not forget that $1,000 is a whole lot more than a couple of loonies. The point Jesus is making in this parable is the generosity of the poor widow. It has nothing to do with the idea that the other people giving are somehow doing it with arrogance and pride. And yet, how many times have we heard the story that way? And the hymn writer has done the same thing yet again, highlighting verse 1 to paint these people. And of course, he's highlighting only the rich when it's everybody. Because that's what Torah says every Jew is supposed to do, contribute 10% of your income. What we've seen happen with this hymn and how we've tended to hear this gospel story is something that happens often, and we must be aware of it. And what that tendency is in an effort to make our hero look good, in this case, Jesus, God, in order to make God look good, in order to make Jesus look like the best one, we slip into a temptation to make others look worse than they are. Because if these people are really bad, then it just makes Jesus look even better. The poor widow looks awesome if these rich guys are being jerks about their giving. But the thing is, it is not necessary to make someone else look bad or to demonize them in order for Jesus to be seen for the good person that he is, and for God to be seen as the wonderful Savior that God is. Let me give you another example of how we do this. And this was in the first part of the gospel reading this morning. Here, Jesus is teaching, and he said, "Beware of the scribes, who like to walk around in long robes, who like to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to have the best seats in the synagogues and places of honor at the banquets. They devour widows' houses and for the sake of appearance say long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation." So, when we read that, what does that make us think about the people Jesus is talking about? Well, first of all, who is he talking about? Well, the scribes, he said, "Beware of the scribes, comma, who like to walk around in long robes and be greeted with respect, get the best seats in the house, all of that. They devour widows' houses. They are worthy and will receive the greater condemnation." When we read it like that, if we do this little grammatical exercise and get rid of all of the descriptive phrases, all we are left with is that Jesus saying, "Beware of the scribes, they will be worthy of greater condemnation." So, scribes are bad, right? That's what Jesus is saying, isn't he? Scribes are bad. So every time we read about Jesus encounter with the scribes, it's like, oh, here are the scribes again. You know, we do the same thing with the Pharisees, right? Oh, here are the Pharisees, here are the Sadducees, they're talking with Jesus. These guys are such losers all the time, and Jesus is so much better than they are. And we end up demonizing the scribes if we read it that way. But I'd suggest that that was the wrong way to read the passage. You see, in the Greek language in which the New Testament was originally written, there's no punctuation marks. And so we've put a comma in here that I think should be removed. Again, the comma says this: "Beware of the scribes, comma, who like to walk around in long robes and be seen and all of that." What if we took out that first comma? Then we read this: "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to have the best seats in the house." Now it's different, isn't it? It's not just saying that the scribes as a whole are bad, but the scribes who like to walk around in those nice garments, the scribes who like to have the best seats in the house, the scribes who do devour widows' houses, they are the ones worthy of greater condemnation. We don't need to demonize somebody to make Jesus look better. And we don't need to ramp up what we think of people that are a bit of a character foil to others. In fact, we don't even need to have them be a character foil from time to time just to make Jesus look good. The scribes had an important role in society. They were the people who were literate. They were the people that could write things down. And so if you were a scribe, if we read it the first way, if you're a scribe, well, you're going to deserve greater condemnation, because apparently scribes are bad, if that's how we read it. But the scribes weren't bad. They were the ones who wrote down the law. They were the ones who copied the Torah so people could follow it. They were the ones who wrote down things that rabbis were saying. They were the ones who were writing down court proceedings. These are the people who could write. And so that was their job. It's an important job. To think that just because they're scribes that they're already, you know, on the wrong side is missing what Jesus is really saying. Instead, beware the scribes who are full of themselves because of their role. Now, can you think of times that this kind of thing has been done, where we make someone else look bad in order to make our hero look good? I got to tell you that 20, 30 years ago, I did this quite often. I bought into the idea that is not uncommon in some Christian circles, dare I say in many Christian circles, that because we favor the religious faith of Christianity and following Jesus and see Jesus as being God in the flesh and all of this, because we favor Jesus and follow Jesus and love Jesus, I bought into the thought then that every other religious expression is actually from the devil, is inspired by Satan, is all the people following other religions are just simply being led down the garden path by the deceiver. And in some cases, it's even demonic. Is that necessary? Is it necessary for Jesus to be seen as who he is? Do we have to say, well, all these guys are not just mistaken or incomplete or something, but these ones are wrong and even evil? Is it necessary to do that to show how wonderful Jesus is? I would suggest to you, no, not at all. And yet we have had a tendency, I know I have had the tendency in years past, to do exactly that. Again, this is not uncommon. And so what we can do instead is simply look at who Jesus is and not worry so much about what everybody else is doing. We can understand what God is like and talk about what God is like without having to say, my God is better than your God. Your God is false. Your God is a deception. We don't have to do that. And I'm not saying that people I'm speaking to right now necessarily do so, but I do know that that tendency often creeps in there. Now, someone might say, well, hold on a second. There is still an important thing of knowing what's really right and knowing that there is wrong. Fair enough, it's true, there is right and wrong. We do need to deal with that. And if we are going to say, well, you know, Reverend Derwin, I mean, after all, we know that Jesus is the one, he is the Savior of the world and all of that, then what else do you do with everybody else? I would simply say, well, we recognize everybody else as being ones who are trying to understand who God is, and they're obviously using a different approach than Christianity is. But does that mean everything that they are doing is patently wrong or false or evil? I think that's jumping to a conclusion that doesn't need to be reached. Instead, we can find that God, who made all things and is revealing all things to all people all around the world, there are people who are picking up on that And we can see, and this isn't hard to do, looking at various religious expressions and finding where conclusions they have made about God mesh with Christian conclusions about God. So would it not be correct that if this religion over here is seeing God as being wise and loving and compassionate, that we would have to say they're right because God is wise and loving and compassionate? Well, of course we do. That doesn't take away from our sense and our appreciation for Jesus. We're just simply acknowledging that they're right. Yeah, that's what God is like. And that's not needing to be made to look bad somehow. Our letter to the Hebrews brings out an interesting point about our perspective. Because if our concern is about trying to see where things are wrong in order to show how right Jesus is, we start viewing life from a much more negative perspective than we ought to. And yet what's interesting is what the writer of the Hebrews says in this passage. The writer of the Hebrews is talking about what Jesus has done on his crucifixion, in his crucifixion, as being the one who has appeared once for all at the end of the age to remove sin by the sacrifice of himself. Right? Talking about Jesus' crucifixion. He's gotten that dealt with, right? The bad stuff is dealt with because of Jesus' crucifixion, right? And then he goes on to say, and just as it is appointed for mortals to die once, and after that the judgment, so obviously there is some kind of evaluation for good and bad and all of that, okay, even though that's part of it, he then goes on and says, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. Let's unpack that a little bit. He's talking about the fact that Jesus is coming again, the second coming of Christ. And of course, there's a lot of debate about what exactly that is, what it looks like, how will we know, has it happened yet, is it yet, has it happened already? Like, there's all sorts of questions about that. Let's just leave those questions hanging there and simply say that the writer to the Hebrews is saying at some point, when Christ returns again, he will appear that second time not to deal with sin. That's been dealt with. That's not the issue. But instead to save, to make completely whole, to bring to completion those who are eagerly waiting for him. Who is it that we would be eagerly waiting for? The one who is preoccupied with all the bad stuff going on? Or the one who has the character of God that we read about in our psalm? Go ahead and take a look at that in the yellow page there again. Let's remind ourselves of what the psalmist is saying God is like. In verse 5, we read that God made heaven and earth, the seas and all that is in them. God keeps his promise forever. God gives justice to those who are oppressed and food to those who hunger. The Lord sets the prisoners free. The Lord opens the eyes of the blind. The Lord lifts up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord cares for the stranger. He sustains the orphan and the widows. You look at this list after this line after line after line after line about all these wonderful things that God is. And then for some reason, the psalmist puts in that word but and goes on with frustrates the wicked. Do we even need to know that? Like, I really wonder what was going on in the psalmist's mind. How come he had to put the but, he frustrates the wicked, in there? You know what? Someone could say, well, back in the Old Testament, that's the way that they were thinking and they wanted to lean on that. But in the New Testament, Jesus has dealt with it. And so when he comes back, he's not there to deal with sin. Jesus is not in his return going to frustrate the wicked. The whole point is to save those who eagerly desire him. Well, what would it be that we eagerly desire? We eagerly desire the God who is all of these wonderful, positive things that we've read about in Psalm 146. And you don't need to know about bad guys in order to want the God who is all of this. My point this morning is for us to be very sure that we focus our attention on who God is, on who Jesus is, and the positive, encouraging, and wonderful way God is described to us in the scriptures, how Jesus is portrayed, and understand that, yes, I want that God. I want to follow that Jesus. And to be careful not to be in a hurry to try to make everybody else look bad in an attempt to try to make our God look good. If we keep our attention on the goodness of God in Christ, then that is what will come out from us in our interactions with others. But if we are constantly being sensitive to the bad, that too is what will come out in our interaction with others. Who would eagerly desire the one who is constantly on the lookout for the bad? I don't think very many people. So let us be sure to communicate the goodness of God in and of God's self, and the glory of Christ in himself. Amen.